Who knows what Jay-Z, J.K. Rowling, Bill Gates and Oprah Winfrey all have in common? Okay, I will tell you then. They have all overcome failure in one shape or form to go on to gain success in their respective careers. Welcome to My Perfect Failure. Join us as we delve into the world of our perfect failures. We will interview, explore, and discuss how our perfect failures can lead us to success. Join us and tune in.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of My Perfect Failure. Today, I'm super duper excited because we have another amazing guest for you. So my guest today, forgive me the pronunciation, this might be corrected in due course, but my guest today is a KRI and Rama Institute certified Kundalini yoga teacher, as well as a singer and a sacred chant recording artist. Her journey began in 2006, having never taken a yoga class of any kind. She stumbled into her first yoga class and knew she'd found the answer. She has since trained extensively with her teachers in Los Angeles. As a student and teacher, she is devoted to sharing this user-friendly yoga as a method of self-healing and self-empowerment. She believes in a modern approach to the practice and encourages practitioners with a come-as-you-are attitude to gently move out of the physical meditative comfort zone in order to experience their authentic self. She currently offers both in-person and live stream classes for people of all levels. So a very, very, very warm welcome to My Perfect Failure. Mumpreet, how are you?
How are you, Paul? It's good to be here.
Well, it's amazing to have you here. So this is kind of like part two, isn't it? Because we already had an amazing conversation, which should have recorded, but we didn't.
We'll just record all of our conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So moving forward, everything gets recorded.
There we go.
Put out lots of insightful, wonderful content. So thanks for your time today. Extremely excited to have my second conversation with you, this time recorded, and to learn and to evolve. So the title of this episode, you came up with a unique title, which I love. I love the sort of the title, and it just really leaned into full curiosity mode, particularly for me. So title is Failure. It's all perspective. You're the creator of your own reality. So I'm going to get into that in a second. But what I want to start with, if I may, is 2006, yoga happened for you. So if we can maybe go back to 2006 and what drew you to yoga, and then how did it impact you after?
Well, I was, as an adolescent, we'll start there.
Okay.
I had struggled with anxiety and depression as an adolescent, probably starting around the age of 11 or 12. And I, you know, started with the kind of antidepressant route when I was probably about high school age, maybe more like 14, 15. And it helped, but then there's other side effects that kind of come out of that. And so I wasn't sold on it as a kind of a lifetime remedy, because it just, something in me was like, this isn't the answer. And it's not to say that it most definitely could be the answer for some people, but just me and my knowing, I knew that it wasn't for me. And so, you know, we progressed to, you know, my kind of early 20s, and I had been on and off, you know, medication, antidepressants in particular, for some years. And by the time I got into my 20s, I was back on antidepressants again. And I was really feeling like, okay, this, you know, it's like it got stronger in me, this knowing of like, you know, we need to not rely on these. Yeah, there has to be another way. And so I was seeking that answer. I was like, what is the answer? And I had started doing, you know, getting more focused on my health. And I started looking at nutrition and diet, exercise and things like this, like really trying to just kind of take it into my own hands. And so I had done some, you know, juice cleansing and things like this. And, you know, those things did help me. But you know, I had tried weaning off the antidepressants and that wasn't, it just wasn't working. It was really difficult. And so I found myself living in Los Angeles and I stumbled into that first Kundalini yoga class. Yeah. And I was never somebody who was like, oh, I want to try yoga. You know, it just wasn't really something that I, you know, I think there's kind of like a stigma, especially for me at that time, there was a stigma about yoga. It's like, and I was a punk rocker, rock and roller. And I was like, oh, that's like hippie stuff, you know, the labels we put on things. And anyway, but I was really kind of desperate for solutions and to have relief. And so I was, you know, it's funny how when we are in desperation and we really deeply want relief, how we get a lot more open to different kinds of solutions. And so that happened for me. And there was happened to be a yoga studio, which was exclusively Kundalini yoga. I didn't know the difference between Kundalini yoga and other kinds of yoga, but it was the one that was closest to where I lived. So I went there. And, you know, after that first class, you know, we did the lie down at the end and I just knew, I was like, oh, this is going to be what helps me to find that relief, because I felt so relieved after that class. I felt so relaxed. All the tension in my body was gone, anxiety, you know, just that the constant thinking, it was gone. I just felt in the moment. And I don't know that I'd ever had that experience before. And so I wound up in that class, and that was kind of the journey. And I started going very regularly. And in probably in less than a year, around 9 months, I was totally off of the medications. And I've never taken any since. And that was, 2006, 2007.
Wow, that's remarkable. Remarkable. The first question I'd like to ask is the type of yoga that you were doing, Kundalini, forgive me if the pronunciation is out, but is there a distinct difference between that type of yoga and maybe more traditional, or are there just a lot of different types of yoga that people take?
Well, it's said that Kundalini yoga, it's also called Kriya yoga. It just kind of depends on the lineage. But it's the umbrella, and that all other forms of yoga kind of fall underneath that umbrella. And it is different in the sense that it incorporates mantra, breathing exercises, and either postures that you hold or repetitive postures. It's going to actually be all of the above oftentimes. And we have hundreds of different Kriyas is what we call them, which is just the sequence of exercises. And so it's pretty rare that you would take the same kind of class twice. Mm-hmm. You know, unlike Hatha yoga, where it's a sequence and they're kind of known sequences. I actually personally don't know that much about Hatha yoga. I'm primarily a Kundalini yogi. I've taken one Hatha class in my career. But that much I know to be true is, you know, Kundalini yoga is, there's a lot more variety. It's different in that sense that you will have breathwork, potentially breathwork, mantra, repetitive movement and held postures. And we always include a meditation at the end as well. It's unique in that sense.
Okay. And this is a curious question, really. I guess all questions are curious questions, but depending on what your mood is, what you do in that yoga session, Well, that really depends on what mood you are. So I guess a better way to ask, are there different forms you can take or different types of stretches or engagements you can do based on what your mood is when you start your session?
As a student or as a teacher?
I guess I'm asking as you individually, as a teacher.
Okay. So my personal practice, I have a practice that I do every day, and I've been doing that practice daily for years. And it's changed here and there. But we, you know, very much advocate for finding that thing that you do daily and do it for a long period of time, because this is where we really, the psyche starts to be shaped by, you could call it, the pattern that we create through the yoga practice. So we have what I like to call the default kind of neural pattern, our coping mechanisms that we've learned by default, just by, you know, existing, whatever our background is, whatever experiences we had, those are the ways we learn to cope. Sometimes they're healthy ways, most of the time they're not. But the Kundalini yoga practice helps us to kind of repattern those neural patterns. So choose to do this on my personal practice. I choose the same Kriya and the same meditations, and I do those every single day. And, you know, I have one meditation that I've done for, I think it's about 1,080 days in a row. And so, you know, not everyone's going to choose to do that. You know, that might not be realistic for everyone. But for me, you know, I'm very dedicated to transforming and mastering my mind in this lifetime. Yeah. And so that is something that we very much advocate for, is like, choose that one Kriya, meditation, mantra that you're doing every day. And that is where, you know, over time, the really deep transformation and healing happens, because you're setting that same rhythm every day, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So absolutely.
That's how I choose. And then I have what I call the kind of practices that are like the accessories that I'll kind of add, you know, depending on how much time I have, I might add, you know, a certain mantra or pranayama or, you know, I have a core fundamental practice, and then I'll add things, you know, depending on, like you said, my mood or what I need to balance myself.
That sounds amazing. And what also sounds amazing is the fact that you went to first session and it had this tremendous impact on you. And so you kind of like had a knowing, it just, everything sort of almost clicked, and you knew that this was something that was going to stick around.
Yeah.
Can you describe that? Or was it just a feeling, an inside feeling?
You know, I think all of us have an inner ability to we have that knowing, but I like to call it, we recognize something. And you can also call it intuition. At that time in my life, I didn't have a lot of experience with, I guess, the language that I have now about recognizing, you know, frequency alignment, synchronicity, whatever you want to call it. I very much still have a relationship with that inner knowing. And I at the time, I don't think I had no idea what it would evolve into. But I still relate to that feeling of like, I just know.
Yeah.
And it might not make sense. You know, there's people in my life, the people close to me, you know, and I still have this experience where I just know something is true. And they're like, and they might not get it. They're like, what is she talking about? Like, because you can't, they might not see what I see.
Yeah,
they don't feel what I feel. You know, and this is why it's so important for us to have this relationship to ourselves, where we have a deep trust to that inner knowing. And no matter what's going on around us and the criticisms or the, you know, whether people understand it or not, that we can just say, no, I know, and I don't need anyone else to give me permission or validate my truth. And I think that is something that from that first class that has very much been cultivated and developed within me through the practice, where I have very little doubt with my intuitive knowing now. In the past, that wasn't the case. I would have doubt. Not to say I don't have doubt from time to time now, but it's, I trust that intuitive knowing more than I trust the, you know, the doubts of my insecurities.
Yeah. I've just written down knowing over logic, because sometimes people, particularly family and friends, when we're doing something and we have an inner knowing, and we might say, well, it could be anything. I'm looking to do this. I'm going to do this. And they immediately lock in to their perspective, their logic, and that overrides any insights or the feeling that we have. And what I love about your journey is that, particularly as it's evolved, you've learned to understand your intuition and trust it. And I think I haven't studied this, but I think that we will find better alignment, better natural happiness than when we try and squeeze ourselves into somebody else's logic, which fits their own perspective that might not even be that aligned. But it's very easy to kind of, when we've got close family, close friends, to really consider their perspective, even if it is at odds with what we, our intuition, to your point.
Yeah. I think that's so true. I mean, we're fundamentally tribal beings. Mm. And so I think that we tend to, there is a longing for acceptance, I think, in a lot of us. And so, you know, it's perfectly natural to, you know, kind of run things by our friends and family and those who are trusted and close. There can be consequence to that, because you have people, you know, who has they're going to interject their point of view, and it's going to come from their personal experience. Yeah. Right. And who knows kind of what their, we call them thought forms, like what kind of is their dominant thought form that's kind of coloring their view of life. And that could be fearful. It could, you know, it happens a lot with parents, you know, because the parents are always like, you know, I don't know, I'll speak for myself. My parents are like, you know, they'll have you considered this? Like, and it's usually like, you know, the most kind of like worst case scenario situation. And I'm like, yes, I have. But that's not coloring my decision. Yeah. Right. But I think, you know, it's just a way that they kind of know how to show like, okay, I'm concerned for your well-being. Yeah. Right. And so, but we have to be able to navigate that and know, okay, their reality, their opinion doesn't have to influence my reality of what I know deep inside myself. And I'd say that is one of the biggest challenges as far as sharing kind of our deepest inspirations and dreams, is knowing how to navigate and stay strong to our truth, and navigate kind of the influence and perspective and projections ultimately of those around us.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, deep down, a lot of us, we do want acceptance, and we want support from those closest to us. We want them to be like, oh, yay, congratulations, or that's a great idea. You know, we want that kind of positive energy behind the things that we're doing. But not everyone can provide that. And so, you know, as I'm also like very practical, I consider myself a very pragmatic person, is like, not everyone can provide that authentically. And why would that be? Because that's not their inner experience for themselves.
Yeah, no, totally, totally. And I think it is a skill to get to that point where we have where we trust our own intuition. And also we've got that ability to acknowledge other people's thoughts and ideas, but we stick to our guns, we trust our intuition, and really we move forward, because definitely I've been there where you kind of lean into a groundswell of other people's thoughts and opinions, and you might do something even when it doesn't feel particularly good. It doesn't, you know, to your point, it doesn't really feel like a knowing. It feels like maybe the opposite of that, whatever. I can't think of a word for opposite of that, but it kind of feels the opposite. But you kind of trust other people more than you trust yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Even they don't know the dynamics of maybe what you've put into a particular journey or a decision we would like to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do think that, you know, just to add to the intuitive part, is we have been conditioned to, how do I put this? That our intuition isn't practical. Mm. And I, like I said, I call myself a pragmatist, and part of that pragmatism is trusting my intuition. That's very pragmatic for me. Yeah. But I also understand that for some people, that is not practical from their perspective.
Yeah.
And I think as a society, you know, in my experience, what I've seen, some of the happiest people are people who have a very deep sense of self-trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think that, so for people listening that may be fascinated with the idea of being able to trust themselves more, maybe they long to trust themselves more, and maybe they're thinking about tapping into other people's advice and placing more priority on what other people's thoughts and opinions are. Over time, they can get there. They can maybe make almost subtle changes, or maybe either write down or and maybe know when they're going to have a conversation with somebody, close friend, family member, but they can maybe make a note, I will respect or acknowledge what they're saying, but I'm going to stick to my guns on this because it feels right.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think whatever it takes to help keep us, keep our vision kind of in priority, mm. our personal vision. And, you know, I think that on a more experiential level, meditation is such a valuable tool for really connecting to ourselves. And that's really what's helped given me or enabled me to cultivate this sense of trust in myself and being able to recognize my intuition when it comes up. Because, you know, when we sit with ourselves and we connect deeply with who we are and we make that habit that we practice daily or regularly, we start to recognize our truth in our day-to-day lives, because we have the experience of it already on a daily basis, we're cultivating it. So then when I'm out in my regular life at my job, or I'm interacting with my family, my friends, my coworker, my partner, whoever it might be, I have a reference point. Okay, I recognize what I'm feeling to be true. And so that, I think, would be kind of the foundation if somebody wants to cultivate a relationship with their intuition with their sense of knowing. Meditation is such a great tool for that. And then, you know, journaling afterwards. I'm not a big journaler, so I'm not going to sit here and say that I journal, but I think, especially from the beginner's perspective, it helps to just have a reference to go back to for some people, especially people who are maybe more on the intellectual side and they like to kind of see the proof, if you will, or the progress on paper. Like, yeah. Journaling can be very helpful for that. So like you were saying, like writing it down, like these are my goals, this is what I feel. And then if they have a conversation where they feel maybe steered off course a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Back.
Yeah. And I think journals are good reference points, because when we're veering off course, consult the journal. I guess everybody does journaling differently, and
mm-hmm.
different people will have different solutions why they do it. And how they can use it. But it's just that reference point to keep us, you know, in focus.
Yeah.
What I wanted to ask, so, and then we can get on to the main theme of our discussion. So when you talked earlier about searching, when things were a little bit challenged as you embarked on your yoga journey, you use that term searching, and it almost thinks, and particularly when we're a little bit desperate and we're a little bit confused, and there's almost value in being there because it can lead to who we really are and who we want to be. So it's almost like a signal that we're not quite there. So we almost should be searching. So it's almost like an acknowledgement that actually, Paul Monpreet, we need to be doing something a little bit different. And this is your search because we're not quite there yet. So I love that. I don't know whether you've ever thought about that or whether you've got any thoughts.
Yeah, definitely. I think that whenever we're unhappy, whenever we suffer, or we don't wake up in the morning feeling like, oh, okay, I'm like ready for this day and feeling just the beauty of life. And the more kind of severe or desperate we feel, to me, that's just it's like the body and the mind are screaming, something's not right. I need something to feel balanced. Whether it's our diet, or we're not exercising enough, or we are not in nature enough, or something's asking for balance.
Yeah.
And the journey of that is finding out what needs to be balanced. Mm. And sometimes it may be, we'd like to, think it's simple. Oh, I'm going to go to the doctor and the doctor is going to have an answer for me. And sometimes that can really help kind of diagnose or for us to figure out what it is that's out of balance. But I think, again, it kind of comes back to that intuition of, okay, if I'm not feeling good, I'm not feeling happy, how do I tune into myself to understand maybe what needs to be changed? For some of us, it's, I find that, I tend to be one of those people who's like, okay, what do I need to change? I don't feel happy. I don't feel good. And usually the answer is you don't need to change anything. You just need to rest. And not think about anything and the pressure and obligation and responsibility and, these things. But ultimately, we can look at that, our feelings of unhappiness, our feelings of imbalance, as an indicator, a signal that there's something required in the realm of self-care. Mm. And the more we develop that relationship to self, our knowing, our inner knowing, our intuition, and really how to take care of ourselves in a deep way, because I think most of us are not taught how to take care of ourselves. We're kind of just, we're born into this life and we're like, okay, this is how you need to operate. You go to school, you need to learn how to work and like hold down a job and make money so you can have these things and, be a productive person in society. But where are we taught to take care of ourselves and all of that? We're not really.
Yeah, today in today's climate where it is 1,000 miles an hour and, mm-hmm. And in some quarters, particularly in some industries, there's this mm-hmm. propensity to think that you have to be seen to be extremely busy.
High performance, high productivity.
High performance. No time for anything but high performance and doing stuff.
And that's considered to be excelling.
Yeah, absolutely.
Succeeding. Yeah. And it's a, wonder why we have so many people who have psychological issues. Mental health is a big part of, it's a big conversation. Ultimately for me, it's like, we just haven't been taught how to take care of ourselves. And beyond that, it's not considered important. It's not emphasized as a part of being, kind of a well-rounded human being. And I think that there is conversation starting as far as mental health, because, Didn't the UK just go to like the 4-day work week? Is it all the UK or some of it?
No. Well,
there's
some,
none of it.
I think it's been, there are some companies that are toying with the idea. One of my friend's companies were exploring that, but I don't think it's fully implemented. There is more of a hybrid model now. So since COVID, well-being is more visible now, is spoken about more now.
So we're in the very beginning fringe of the conversation.
Mental health. Because I think for some companies, and there will be some companies that are doing a great job, but I think for some it's almost like a soundbite. And as we've come further out of COVID, I think that well-being isn't as vocal now, to my mind.
Okay.
And I'm not sort of the oracle on it, but I think that it's very easy. And I think there is maybe a tendency to be going back to what was the norm before, which is, you know, full work mode, well-being.
Right. Okay. Extreme productivity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, which is obviously not a good thing. And hopefully there'll be people out there saying, Paul, no, well-being is on the table and we are doing more. So if that is the case, then definitely would like to hear about that. And then lastly, I wanted to add that what I like about searching and what you found is the idea that we become more open. We become more invested in considering other things. And I like that idea, because when we're a closed book, obviously we've got a limited scope in terms of where we're going to go, what can happen, and really exploring ourselves. So I like that idea of, sounds counterintuitive, being in a difficult moment and being more open to explore. But I like the idea that we can become more open, and we should almost embrace it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it will be so different for each person. I think how much they can open in their life. And I think there's so many layers to that, but I do think it's such an important part of our own healing, our own sense of well-being, because we can't be just accepting that, how do I put this? It's almost like the common kind of narrative, if we're not doing well, is like, oh, it must be something wrong with me. Mm. Rather than looking at our environments and perhaps the people we're spending our time with and the lifestyle as not supportive for our own happiness. Only I can make the change at the end of the day. I am the only person who can make me happy. I'm the only person responsible for my health, for my mental health. However, sometimes that responsibility looks like, okay, I need to change the way that I eat. I need to change the kind of people that I'm around. Mm. I need to change my job. And so even though we have on a systemic level, the way that, you know, we are conditioned towards working is not necessarily the most supportive for mental health and physical well-being. Only I can decide, okay, I need to find another way. Mm. And I think that can be very difficult because, you know, somebody's maybe been at their job for 10, 20, a long time, and they feel safe there because it's what they know, but also maybe miserable. And so, again, you know, that if we can develop that meditative practice, which ultimately when we connect to self and we have a sense of connection to kind of the infinite or the universe or whatever you want to call it, God, to me, it's all one. But then we kind of can develop not only a trust in ourselves, but a trust in the mystery, a trust in the unknown, and knowing like, oh, okay, it's scary to leave my job, but I trust that there is that the universe has got my back, so to speak, that it's working in my favor. And if I make choices that support my happiness and health, that they will be reciprocated energetically.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing, I think, for some people to just have faith in.
Yeah.
And faith is a good word. You do it. You have to have faith that the universe is conspiring in your favor.
It's an interesting one, really. And then I want to get into the title. I'm just so fascinated by this discussion, because I think faith, trust, and sometimes we have a knowing, but because we know there's a journey to get there, because we might get that tinge of excitement or that knowing, but there's some resistance because we know that we haven't engaged that before. It's a little bit different and
it can be scary.
Yeah. And it's almost getting to the point where going into the resistance, that's where our life begins, or the next chapter of our life, because that's where the journey is, where we are. Like, there's an example that you gave around somebody that's in a job that they've done for 10 years. They, you know, wonderful comfort there, because I know the fabric of the business. I know what a good day looks like. I know what a bad day looks like. But actually, am I happy? Do I bounce out of bed in the morning? Do I have to drag myself out of bed in the morning? Do I have to go through the same repetitive exercise? And you feel that obviously it's probably an easy when we're conditioned, but it's not firing their soul or our soul.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's kind of how I gauge my state of being and wellness is, am I waking up in the morning and I feel good and I feel inspired with what I'm doing in my life, what I'm offering, what I'm creating, the people who are around me? Do I feel like I'm able to manage that and maintain my inspiration? And, you know, if that's not the case, then I know, okay, either I need to attend to myself, on a physical level, so whether it's diet or exercise, maybe an emotional level could be, do I need to sleep more? Do I need rest? Do I need more alone time? Do I need to commune in nature? Or spiritual? Do I feel like I need to just sit down and meditate and connect with myself? Or chant for a little while. And so really that is kind of how, you know, it's those three categories for me. And sometimes it can help to simplify. So we have, you know, they say, you know, mind, body, spirit. So, you know, those three things, if we start to kind of, you know, reduce it to those things, it can become much less complicated when it comes to how to balance ourselves. And usually it's going to fall in one of those three categories. And usually if you correct one, or you rather than correct, you kind of become active in one, the others might kind of balance, or you start to have an awareness of maybe, oh, okay, maybe I should sit down and meditate after I went, you know, to the gym, or I went for a jog. Now I know, oh, okay, I've cleared kind of the physical stress for my body, so I can see the other parts more clearly. So usually, you know, if somebody is just starting out and they don't really know where to start, I say just try one of those things in those three categories. It's like you could do yoga, change your diet, or, you know, start meditating. And usually it will kind of start to activate the other areas as in that trinity, if you will.
Okay, lovely, lovely. So I want to lean into your amazing title that you came up with for this discussion. So failure, it's all perspective. You're the creator of your own reality. And I think some of the discussion already has leaned into that. But what I was keen to get your thoughts on, the title, what does failure mean to you? And I love the perspective idea, it's all perspective.
Failure, what does it mean to me? The thing that's hitting first is the times that I feel like I've failed is when I feel like I've betrayed myself. That's really, to me, the only thing failure equates to in my realm, in my understanding. Because even if we have failed someone else, we've primarily failed ourselves first, you know? And that's just the ripple effect, if you will, of the consequence of the self-betrayal. And if we look at our lives, you know, just moving on to this creating your reality, fundamentally speaking, human beings, we are creative. We are creative on a fundamental level because we're creating in every moment of every day. With each breath, I'm creating. With each breath, I'm receiving. You know, I'm creating a movement. I'm creating a sound. So by my breathing, by the sounds that I make, the movements I make, I'm creating a vibration, a frequency that doesn't just end once the sound ends, once the movement ends. It's literally that vibration is moving out into the environment. So if I start to become aware on a fundamental level that I'm always creating anyway, then I can ask myself, what am I creating with my thoughts, with my sound, with the way that I move? And it, for me, makes it much easier for me to take responsibility for what I'm creating, because I'm already creating it all the time anyway, through, you know, the things I've just described. So how can I refine that? And for instance, the way that I speak to others, how can I create something beautiful with that? Whether it's, you know, your Uber driver, or, you know, the clerk at the grocery store, or my partner, or my family, or any person I communicate with. If I'm creating something, I'm creating at least 50% of that interaction, you know? So what can I create there? I can create beauty, or I can, you know, even if I'm feeling maybe not 100% that day, and feeling kind of cranky or irritated because I have to wait, or, you know, we all go through these things. But what if I'm conscious of what I'm creating in that moment? I can also say, can I create beauty even now with the way that I communicate to this person who I feel impatient with?
That's interesting, actually. So you use that. You can, it's almost like a superpower where you can use that ability to create in the moment, even when we feel that we're frustrated and we just want to, whether we're in traffic or whether we're having to wait in wherever it may be, to have that ability where we can just create something which is in line with who we think we are. There might be other analogies you can use to that, but I love that analogy. I've never really thought about tapping into a creator mode where I can really control the situation.
I mean, and it's really just recognizing our own innate power to influence our environments. We all have it, but most of us have a difficult time being conscious, or we're more, you know, the emotions are stronger, because emotion is stronger than logic. Maybe you've noticed. So can I use my logical mind to create the experience that I want to have in life? And then it really is executing our consciousness in as much as possible in life, because I know through my experience that if I engage with people in a way that is irritated, impatient, frustrated, angry, what am I contributing to that situation? I'm creating and amplifying more of the experience of that irritation, frustration, anger, and I'm then projecting that onto another person who will most likely, not everyone, but it's common that the other person will respond with that same energy. So I've learned this to be true through my own experience in life. So I'm not saying that I'm perfect at it, but it is a priority for me to go into interactions with offering energetically, and again, through what I'm creating, through my voice, through the words I use, the vibration, or whatever you want to call it, of what the experience that I want to have. Because if I can have a loving communication, even in those moments, then the chances of that person reflecting that back, or even throughout the rest of their day, are much higher.
Yeah.
So it's almost on a fundamental level, taking responsibility. Oh, I am potentially I'm creating my own reality with what I want to feel by the way that I interact with people in my day, but also perhaps that can change the trajectory of their day because they had this one person who was very kind and sincerely kind to them, you know, and then they feel maybe perhaps inspired. You never know. Maybe it won't do anything, but I'm not really worried about that. Mm-hmm. I'm just mostly it's creating the experience that I want to have.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having good faith that it's creating something beyond just an enjoyable experience for myself.
Yeah. So in those tricky moments, because we always have, say, what we can't control or what other people do, but we can control how we react to what other people do. So when we have those moments where maybe, so one of my bugbears is when I like to say thank you and please. So if you hold the door open for somebody, particularly in the morning, and they just like, you hold the door open for them, then they just let it swing. They don't acknowledge it. Hopefully I'm better. I never engage that person, but I will think, maybe they could have said something like thank you, maybe. Mm-hmm. But in those moments when those, I guess, little annoying things happen, do you lean into your emotion and sometimes just say, sometimes we can do something just to kind of, so they might be having a bad day. They might have had an argument with their partner. They might have, anything could have happened. So do we give them grace in those moments? Because if we give them grace, it controls our energy. And also it might improve their energy.
Yeah. I mean, I think you nailed it. It's just giving grace in those moments, you know, especially something like that where there's very little engagement and sometimes it's like, you know, I'd say some people just, they don't have the awareness. Yeah. They might not even be conscious of what just happened. They might, because, you know, we tend to go through life thinking that people kind of are aware of what we're aware of, you know, like, oh, you know, this is just like common courtesy. This is etiquette. This is, you know, but perhaps that person wasn't trained or taught that way. And they have no idea that they're, you know, they're going through life, like letting doors close on people. You know what I mean? They don't know. And so I think that that's part of the grace is, and the compassion is like, okay, some people, they're just not as aware of how they affect their environment. So just because I'm working on my consciousness with how I can contribute and how I do contribute to the space, I can't expect other people to do the same. Mm. And that's kind of, there has to be like just a touch of altruism in it, because we just have that good faith that, okay, I'm just putting my heart forward and the offering grace in these spaces. And it's because I want to do it because it makes me feel good. And through that, hopefully it will uplift others, but I can't expect other people to be conscious of the same things.
I love that.
It's kind of cool to swallow.
I love that analogy because it kind of gives us more control, and it's not, to your point, you can't expect everybody to be a mirror reflection of what we do. And to my point about that door example, as you were talking, you just triggered a thought. And actually, maybe even sometimes I've been that person that's not said thank you, because we have those moments when we're just deep in thought. Mm. We're just deep in thought, thinking about, it could be anything. It could be work. It could be a friend. It could be family. It could be anything. And we're deep in thought, and we can get back to wherever we're doing. Actually, I didn't. And for a millisecond, we might acknowledge to ourselves, you know what? I didn't ask so-and-so how they were doing today, or I didn't maybe reference that person that kindly opened the door for me. And it can be just because we're in the moment. We're just engaged in thought.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think most of us are just distracted perpetually. Yeah. and I think, you know, again, having that, you know, I call it compassion, is just, you know, what they call like a pre-forgiveness.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, hey, like, I have no idea what's going on with the other person. You know, Even if, you know, it's something more extreme, like someone like, you know, swears at you driving or on the street, or, you know, all kinds of like weird stuff happens. And, you know, ultimately being able to hold this perspective, like, it's actually more a reflection of their state of being than my own.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Like, yeah. Okay. Even though it's like, you know, there's people out there, they're assholes. If people act like assholes, like, no one's denying that. But can I also just know that it's, number one, not worth it for me to engage that, because that's just not the kind of experience I'm looking to have. I'm not looking to have, like, you know, hostile exchanges with anyone. And so can I look at it like, wow, that's really unfortunate that that's, you know, how, like, that's basically their understanding of how to, or, yeah, I guess that's the only way I can put it. Their understanding of how to handle the situation.
Yeah.
That's like the best of their ability in that moment. And that's not fun for them.
Yeah,
it's not fun for me either.
Yeah.
But as somebody who feels a little more self-possessed, a little bit more like, okay, it's not about me. It's like they're having this whole trip over here, and I'm just going to continue with this trip that I actually enjoy. Yeah. And part of that is I'm not really interested in entangling with people's neurosis or anger or, you know, unpleasant emotions. You know, I'm just like, if someone wants to kind of project those things on me, I can just be like, oh, okay, I see it for what it is. It doesn't mean it won't affect me, but, you know, on a deeper level, I do understand that it's not about me. And that helps me to move on, and it helps me to stay in my grace, because I know what kind of experience I want to have.
Yeah.
And I just want to enjoy life.
I love that analogy, and I agree with it. I think the author, I forget the author's name, Summit McGuell, who wrote Four Agreements, he talks something, I'm sure he mirrors you when he talks about the idea that when we're having those conversations or those moments where we're getting somebody's negative energy, again, he mirrors what you're saying. It's like, we don't know what's going on with them. We don't know what's going on with them. So the idea is we shouldn't take it at face value.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my analogy of what he was saying, and we shouldn't I guess confront the situation, because we don't know what they're dealing with. And I think that's a nice way to be able to move beyond, not let our emotion, our energy be corrupted by somebody that's got a bunch of things going on, and they may not have the tools
emotionally
exactly. To kind of release a better type of energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, we're always going to have these kinds of interactions. And it's like, we're one person who maybe feels a bit more self-possessed will have to kind of take the higher road and see it for what it is. And I think that's why it's so important that people kind of work on themselves and cultivate, you know, a connection to themselves or their meditative mind, because it can create a lot less, I mean, violence. And if people have these kind of ways of managing our own emotions a little bit more in a healthy way, where we look at it like, you know, I'm creating my reality.
Mm.
And it doesn't mean that we're all going to have moments where maybe we're not as graceful as we wanted to be.
Yeah.
But can I, even with that, say, okay, I felt like I could have been more graceful about that. And how would I handle it differently? Because we feel the repercussions of when we're not in grace. And I also want to say there are times when we shouldn't be in graceful, if, you know, in situations where we feel like, you know, we're being like accosted or, you know, like physically harmed, or, you know, we're those things, it's like, absolutely do not have to be graceful. That you remove yourself from that situation. I in no way want to say that, you know, we just need to sit there and smile through the, you know, abuse or anything like that. But it's more on those kind of day-to-day interactions where, you know, we're all here, we're all human, we're all trying to kind of understand and navigate things to the best of our ability. And we have to, that compassion, that pre-forgiveness is knowing that not everybody is going to have that sense of awareness of what they're creating.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? Absolutely. And just saying, okay, like, there's people out there like that. There's people out there who don't have, you know, they're not in control. They're not in any a mastery of their emotional state or what they're putting out there. And, you know, I'm going to have to navigate that in the scheme of things, but choosing the way that I navigate it will make a huge difference in my quality of life.
Yeah, no, I love that analogy, and the tools that you're providing are wonderful. I just wanted to ask a question around failure. It's all perspective. So that word perspective, I think, is important, because I think that if we tap into maybe the way that failure is positioned in society, we might be tapping into that perspective, that if you don't achieve something, I don't know, a milestone, but I guess like me, you get made redundant from a job, you might have a perspective, but that's failure. But it's not. It's the fact that you're able to go for something, you're able to do something, you're able to put all your energies into something. What did you learn from that? What are the takeouts from that? It's about really improving and understanding a better perspective. Like, and I love your analogy, which I've written down. Failure is when we betray our reality. And it's about having, because if we're living and we're trying to be the best version of ourselves in any given form or any given situation, but doesn't quite work out, that shouldn't be contrived or construed as failure, because it's almost like the wrong perspective. We've got it wrong. It's when we don't betray, which to your, I'm plagiarizing here, but it's like when we betray ourselves and we don't actually go for something and we don't lean into that intuition. So I'd just love to get your sort of thoughts around that.
Well, I think that success and failure are something that are, in reality, very personal. But I think that what's common with our kind of what constitutes success and failure is we're basing it on the standards of others. So when I feel like, you know, if someone feels like they failed because they didn't get the job that they wanted, or they're not making the money they feel like they deserve, they're usually basing that on someone else's standard of what it is to succeed or fail. So for myself, you know, even in my 20s, you know, people would say like, okay, what's your goal? Like, what is your primary goal in life? And it, for me, it was to be happy. That was more important to me than anything. And so if you look at that from the terms of how much money a person makes, what kind of car they drive, you might be like, oh, like, you know, like that person is a failure, because they're equating it to what their standards of success or failure are. right? So maybe for some people, it is important to, you know, have the car and you know, make lots of money. And those things are perfectly okay, I might add. But not, you know, to me, if I have those things, but I'm unhappy, I don't feel successful.
Yeah.
You may be successful in a certain kind of realm of thought, right? The capitalist realm of thought. It's like you're succeeding if you're working. This is, you know, I live in the United States. It's like the American dream is to, you know, be like a millionaire and have the house and the car and the whole thing, right? But is that success if you are miserable and you feel trapped and you know? Maybe it's enough success for some people. They're like, oh, I don't really feel happy, but I have all these things, so I feel satisfied to some degree. And so I think it's really determined upon the individual. And, you know, I'm very passionate about not allowing my sense of success or failure to be determined by the capitalist status quo.
Yeah.
Yeah. So productivity and like, you know, I get into it. I'm a doer. I'm a inspired, creative person. I have a lot of ideas and I like to implement those ideas and create things. But I also can easily get caught up in like, oh, I need to be productive. I have to do this today. I have to do that today. And I at times even I can ignore the needs of my soul, my body, my mind. And so I very much practice saying, you know what? No, it's very productive for me to rest. It's very productive for me to be in nature. It's very productive for me to have stillness in my mind and to kind of, you know, clear my schedule of, you know, doing and being busy. And so this is, for me, it's a more holistic approach on productivity. Like, you know, it's productive to take a nap.
Yeah. Well, I think I've read somewhere, and I'm sure it's fact, that when we have those still moments, those quiet moments, that's when stuff happens. It's like when we are recharged and we lean into those thoughts that don't have time to kind of come to the surface when we're in that frantic doing mode where they just don't have time to kind of just come through. So I think that relaxing mode is important. And we talked about well-being earlier. When we are well-being to ourselves, that's actually when we can be more productive, when we're productive. If we're just, I know for me, when I'm trying to push the boundaries, I don't perform consistently. When you have that overload moment, when we don't always know when I guess for different people, it will be different, but we hit the overload where actually it's like a battery where it's going to fade away. And I think that's how we fade away our performance. And when we just keep on going and going and going, invariably, we don't see that same level of enthusiasm. Even if we enjoy something, there has to be a recognition that, you know, we're not going to produce our best when we are just going, 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 and going without having that us time to kind of really deliver and offer our best.
Yeah. And I think it becomes then a grind. You know, it's like, okay, I'm literally just maintaining the baseline of my commitments and responsibilities, but my heart's not in it. I don't feel inspired. Like, and to me, that's that indication of, okay, it's time to rest. It's time to take a little space, because if I recharge my battery, then that kind of zest and excitement will come back. And, you know, yeah, we won't be as productive because it becomes harder to make decisions. Yeah. I know for me that if I have a hard time like making a decision about something, It's usually because I'm feeling really busy and I can't connect to my intuition and knowing like, okay, what's going to be best for me. So I go, okay, you know what? You have a little time. Ideally I have a little time, but usually I will have a little time before I need to make a decision. And I go, okay, just give yourself a little time to rest. And when, if I do that, then the answer comes.
Yeah.
And I know how I want to navigate something. But if I'm just busy all the time and chronically fatigued and exhausted, it becomes very hard to live an authentic, healthy life because we're just basically doing what we need to do to get by in order to maybe it's like so I don't get fired from my job. It's like the minimum level of productivity at that point. And, ideally we want to enter our lives with that excitement and inspiration to show up for the day. And we have, a surplus to give, rather than just that baseline.
Yeah, running on empty.
Yeah. And I think most people, that's how they're kind of, that is how a lot of people are operating in life is that baseline, because most people I think are so exhausted just by, the demands that it is to kind of, quote unquote, be a productive, participant in society is deeply exhausting. And not that productive, by the way.
And it is interesting.
Not spiritually anyway.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I think a lot of people can recognize with that baseline how they're operating and running on empty. And I think a lot of the tools that you've outlined in this discussion, people can implement and use them really to lean into their intuition, trust themselves and look after themselves. I think you mentioned mind, body, spirit. Look at that. Those are wonderful things to look at. It might be all of them might be out of sync, but I think you said if you work with one, then invariably the others will come back in to play. I'm conscious of your time because I've robbed you of more time than I scheduled this call for.
It's a pleasure.
but we definitely have to do this again because I really enjoyed this. And if I can ask you two more questions, if I may. One is for people listening that have loved everything that you've said and we've covered. And the final part of the question is, we can be the creator of our own reality. And we've kind of covered that. But for people listening that thinking, actually, I'd like to start today and maybe tap in to being the creator of my own reality. Is there a bit of advice you might have for them around that?
Yes, meditate.
Okay, meditate. Okay.
That's the best place to start.
Yeah.
Because it's very difficult to change our reality with the default programming that has created our current state of imbalance or unhappiness. Okay. So in order to change that default programming, I start reprogramming by sitting with myself, connecting with myself, connecting with my breath. And if somebody is interested and they've never meditated before and they want, like a program or something, to guide them, you can go to my Instagram and I have many, many.
I love your Instagram.
My reels,
your Instagram is amazing.
Oh, good. Yeah, there's entire 40-day meditations in my reels. If you go to the reels section,
okay, I need to look at that.
So somebody could do it'll be the same meditation every day for 40 days, and they could, follow that program to its entirety, or, we recommend that, but of course, we're householders, we do what we can. So that would be a great way to, introduce oneself to a meditative practice. So that's available to you if you want.
And I've expressed a desire to have another conversation with you because we haven't got, because you're an amazing artist, so singer and chant recording artist, and maybe we can explore that further on another discussion. But obviously you're amazingly talented, put out wonderful material, but maybe you might want to speak a few words around that, how you got into it.
Sure. You know, it was just the sacred chant, the mantra recordings are really kind of a manifestation, if you will, of just my love for the practice of Kundalini yoga and meditation and the mantras that we incorporate. And they're Gurbani chants. So, you know, Kundalini yoga is, has a very substantial influence from Sikhism. And so the mantras that we use are Gurbani Sikh mantras. And so I've recorded an album with those mantras, and it really was just, I've been a singer for some years before I started my practice.
Yeah, I can ask you that. So thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. So for me, I was like, this is just what I feel in my heart that I not only want to do for myself, but I also want to give and kind of contribute to this legacy and to, you know, this culture that has given me so much. You know, it's like, okay, this is what I can offer that will contribute to this legacy forever. And, you know, it might be just a drop, but it's something I felt really strongly that I wanted to do in order to kind of give something back.
Yeah,
it's the best
way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I will be listening more. Like they serve perfect moments when that when we're looking for the equilibrium and we're looking just for clarity and just to relax, close eyes, listen to, just be uplifted, then you're good to go. So amazing stuff. And I guess people, so what I'm going to do, Instagram, that's going to go in the show notes, and your website with access to your music and to everything else. So if people want to reach it, so if people want to contact you for anything, whether it be music or I don't know, whether people can work with you or hire you, what does that look like in terms of people contacting you?
They can find me via the contact on my website, or they can message me on Instagram. Both are perfectly
okay. Perfect. And the last question is, so if you could invite three inspirational people for dinner, they can be alive or past, who would you invite?
Yeah, this one was tricky for me, and all of these people are past.
Okay. Really?
But you know, it's almost like the people who are no longer with us, it's like, you know, I know I'm never going to get that chance in this mm-hmm. lifetime. The ones who are here alive, I'm like, okay, maybe that could happen. So I don't, but so the first one on the list is Mary Magdalene.
Okay.
Very strong connection to Mary Magdalene. I went to France this last spring, and I went to the different kind of sacred sites of Mary Magdalene, and it was a very profound experience for me. And her energy is just very strong in those areas, and definitely palpable for those who are open to it. And then, of course, through that, Jesus, because it's Jesus.
Yeah.
And I had this awareness while I was there. I was like, oh, okay, you know, aside from, I'm not a religious person. So aside from, you know, the religious context, it was very clear to me that these people are just profound healers mm-hmm. and they have profound healing abilities. And, you know, at the time, those things were perceived much differently and perhaps more rare. So definitely Jesus. And then also Guru Nanak, who was the first of the 10 Sikh gurus, and who basically, you know, started, he kind of was the father of the Sikh faith, and really, you know, a lot of these teachings of Kundalini yoga and meditation are based on the teachings of Guru Nanak,
okay,
philosophy, if you will. Okay. So I'd love to sit down and have a dinner with the three of them and just listen and just see what they have to say to each other.
That would be the fascinating piece, wouldn't it?
Yeah. It's like, no, don't, I'm not even here.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll ask a question every now and then just to see, you know, but I'd love to just be at a table and listen to them have a conversation.
Mm. That would be fascinating about what they would talk about. That would be, oh, wow. Well, the mind boggles, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Texas and that.
Monpreet, thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed this discussion. So we've had part one, wasn't recorded. We've had part two, is recorded. So part three, if we can record that, that'd be great.
Recorded. Yeah.
Okay, that would be amazing. But thank you so much for your time. It's been amazing, amazing.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure to be here. I always love talking to you, Paul.
Well, thank you, thank you. And thank you, everybody, for tuning into this episode of My Perfect Failure. We're always looking to grow this show. So please do share this episode, particularly if you know people that are looking to explore purpose, explore perspective, and really lean into who they are and their own intuition and achieving their life ambitions. And your feedback is most welcome. So we're keen to hear about the things you like and equally the things you don't like. So you can find me at paul@myperfectfailure.com, or you can find me via the contact page on the website. So take care for now. Bye.
Thanks for listening to My Perfect Failure podcast. Be sure to visit www.myperfectfailure.com to join the conversation. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Google Play. Look out for our next episode.